Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. I'm here with Kirk and JB. This evening, we're counting the entire country now. I want to apologize in advance because right now I'm getting a whole lot of static. But I'm in South Florida, and the place where I am appears to have very poor cellular connectivity. So, can you all still hear me?
Very much.
Yeah.
Very well.
And there's a little bit of static, but we'll deal with it.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry for the static. I'll try to move around, and we'll try to deal with it the best place possible. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to start with a passage that we went over. In fact, we're going to start with two that we went over in our last program. And it's because I have a word that I want to highlight in Yeshaya 53:8. And then Kirk has three that he wants to make a point by highlighting in 53:9. So let's pick up where we were a week ago, particularly because of these words. Because within each individual word, there are the details that help us put together the entire picture. This begins, first, which is men. Oppressive incarceration, which is poster. Being restrained, enslaved, unable to move, to be withheld. And on account of, and this is the word, mishpat, of the means to justly resolve disputes. He was led away. On behalf of those who would live with him in future generations, who will give serious consideration to this situation, recognizing that truthfully, he came to exist and was separated from the realm of the living. Because of the defiance and rebellion of my people, the assault upon the plague was directed toward him. The word that I want to emphasize is mishpat. And the reason I want to emphasize mishpat is I take a lot of what I think are calculated risks, extrapolations, if you will, in my translating. Mishpat is one of those terms. It is from the Hebrew word shafat, which means to exercise good judgment, to differentiate between right and wrong, good and bad, innocent and guilty. And with the mis in front of it, of course, the ma, as an interrogatory, tells us that this is a term that is being used to direct our attention to the what, the how, the why, the where, and the when of judgment. Now, that alone for me gave me confidence that I could consistently render mishpat, because it is used throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, in a way that I don't think anyone else ever has, at least no one in the last 2,000 years, which is to consistently present Mitzvah as the means to justly resolve disputes, to present the Mitzvah as if it were a synonym for Pesach and Matzah, leading to Bikurim and Shavuot, as if it were the explanation of how we walk to Yahweh and become perfect. And there have been lots of reinforcing statements that Yahweh has made that indicated that this interpretation, this extrapolation, this line of reasoning was valid. That its mishpat is the means to exercise good judgment and make just decisions regarding the means that Yahweh has chosen to resolve disputes as our ultimate judge. But this particular passage, it does a marvelous job of reinforcing that not only is a correct translation, but that Yahweh intended what Yosha did on Pesach and Matzah to serve as the living embodiment of Mishpat. Now, I don't claim to be bragging here. I'm capable of getting a lot of things wrong. But this is a profound insight. This is an insight that changes, fundamentally changes, the way that Yahweh wants us to view Him and the answers that He has provided so that we might be right, that is so profoundly different than the world of religion and the world of common translation, that when the efforts, the intensity, the passion, the devotion, I think the reason and open-mindedness that I've devoted to these past more than 15 years to translating Yahweh's word, when something this important is affirmed and it's this relevant and pertinent to our lives and our relationship with Yahweh and the means that He has provided to reconcile our relationship, I think it's really important to emphasize that. Family members in the covenant, this is one we got right. In this statement, this thing serves as irrefutable proof of that. Through the impressive incarceration, that is the fulfillment of Matzah, and on account of the means to justly resolve, exercising good judgment regarding the prescription and plan to vindicate by resolving a controversy from Shavuot, to decide, to judge, to discriminate, to exercise good judgment, to resolve controversy, to validate, and to be discriminated. This is that's the definition of Matzah. But in its fulfillment, we're talking about this was after Pesach, and everyone thinks he's dead, from the Christian point of view, he died. And, he was off buried with the couple of rich dudes. And he just hung there until he decided to bodily get up and nothing else happened. Well, he says the opposite of that, doesn't he? He was led away. Well, if he was led away, his soul is still alive, isn't it? And it went someplace else. Laka. He was grabbed hold of. He was taken away to suffer on behalf of those who would live with him in future generations. It is not as a result of Pesach, but as a result of Matzah, that we are allowed to live with Yahweh, because it is through Matzah that He has made us right. And it's only to those who give serious consideration to this situation, Sirach, that ponder this information, that care about these implications, that speak out regarding the thinking behind this particular narrative, even complaining over certain aspects of it. This, God is telling us that what is happening in terms of the fulfillment of the Mishpat, so that we can have a relationship with Him, is essential for us to know if we're going to be right. And he goes on to say, that's truthfully emphasizing it. Indeed, he ceased to exist and was separated from the material realm of the living. Absolutely. He was separated from the body. His soul was. He was separated, set apart into the realm of the dead. Sheol. This is a prophetic portrait 700 years in advance of its fulfillment, of what happened on the Shabbat of Matzah in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. Because the defiance and rebellion, the Pasha, the offensive failures, defiant crimes, the contrarian nature, the trespasses, and errant steps of my people, the assault upon the plague was directed at him. Embarrassingly, sadly, most of us were either religious or political. I was one who was actively involved in teaching. I guess the only advantage of it is that having lived that way, I am so grateful for having been set free of it. Having been that way, I'm so grateful for knowing the truth. Having lived that
you're
way,
in a better position to make the argument against it.
Yeah, coming from the inside.
And for my people, my family, the assault of the plague, religion, plague of death. There's only one plague. I mean, if you study the history of Israel, can you name an actual pandemic plague that affected Israel?
Or none.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about it. You know, all of the plagues that went through the world, is there ever a plague that decimated Israel?
Huh?
No, not that I know of.
No, not that I know of either. So when he's talking about the plague of death, that the fulfillment of Matzah resolved, the plague of death is religious and political corruption, which is the only way that man in math, men and women in math, revolt against God. Pesha is not individual transgression. It's not the stuff that Dode did where, he was a bad boy some of the time. But his bad stuff was just bad behavior. He was never religious. He was never actively trying to assert his will over other people. So this is, Pesha is religious and political rebellion and defiance of God, and the assault against that plague was directed. Properly translated, thought about, those words and 53:8 are as important as any ever written. So, Kirk, I know you wanted to go through 53:9, but as I was preparing for tonight's show, I looked at Misfot there again, and it causes me almost to have goosebumps when after, 15, 16, 17 years of doing something, being passionate about it, loving it, finding these insights and being able to share them, you come across a word that is so essential, so unique to what we have come to know, and you see it so brilliantly presented, so as to affirm that our perspective, our understanding, is not only correct, but has been validated.
Oh, yeah. Well, two thoughts. Misbot, everything you said is what you'll find looking if you look it up. And it's also in the five terms and conditions in the Mitzvah are related as far as this is the method of which all that will take place, how he's able to do that, how he's able to judge and govern and execute judgment correctly and fairly.
Right.
And then you think, it's the meaning to resolve dispute. It says procedure. It's the way prescribed. It's what is right. It's standard bearer. It's based on the fulfillment of the mikros. So everything you said is
One of the things, Kirk, we have found is that, and again, this is an extrapolation. This is something I just stumbled on when I was trying to translate Yeshayah 9, 6, and 7. Because there are words there that were only used there, and the only difference between those words and the common use of the word was the mach in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And That was another extrapolation. I spent days on it. And I came to this this insight, this appreciation, that all of a sudden shed light on everything else that we had talked about. Mikra from Kara, what was the Ma doing in front of Kara?
It was pointing.
What is the Ma doing in front of Shaphat? To create Mishpat. And it dawned on me that finally, after doing all this work, that Ma is interrogatory. You know, religious people think it's this like, great assault on God's nature to question him. I would never question God. Well, that's what he wants you to do.
Abraham asked questions.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Ma tells us that we should ask the important questions. That what is it about judgment that we ought to know? When did these things regarding judgment occur? What's important for us to exercise good judgment regarding? How did Yahweh come up with the means to resolve disputes through the exercise of justice? The who, the where, the why, the how, the what, the when. Not only of Shaphat, of exercising good judgment or resolving disputes, as a judge who for who, the why, the when, the what of the invitations to call, be called out.
That makes perfect sense.
That you say are on a simple concept that's rendered just a little different with this introduction of Ma. All of a sudden, they become the things that we ought to be pondering.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I think it's a
profound
insight into the language.
Yeah. When you mention plague, though, if you think about it, if you were celebrating the Mikras, if you're walking down the correct path, I mean, you can be a jerk. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am many times. You can be wrong, and you can do a lot of things. But if you're doing those things that are most important for Yahweh, that are most important to Yahweh, then you're in the family and you can claim all the promises of protection or whatever. The chance of a plague hitting Israel under those conditions can't happen. And the plague that kills them and always killed them was when they went religious. Everything they get kicked out of is religion. So that's the plague. So, all your deductions, I would say, were quite correct. Are you still with us?
What? Did we lose Craig?
We may have. We may have.
Well, he's got.
Well, I was
going
to go to
53.9.
Should I do that till we get him back?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Okay. What I was talking to Craig about and JB about.
Yeah, I was just disconnected. Cellular coverage here is really poor, but I did make it my back end. You guys can hear me?
Yeah, we're about to go to 53.9, but if you want to continue on, let's not.
No, 53.9. Go right ahead. And if I cut out again, you just carry on without me. I'm here devoted to this program, but the cellular networks are.
Okay,
so I'm 53.9, and then you deal with it, okay, Kirk?
Okay.
And they gave him over. They gave him over, Nathan. Nathan is one of the most common verbs in Hebrew. And in addition to being a gift, it means to place, to assign, but to give. So they gave him over to the unrighteous, Rasha, the errant and wrong, those who are guilty, the wicked, evil, criminals. I would say that he was given over to the fallen Moloch and to the religious and political criminals in league with the Moloch, in conjunction with the rock-hewn tomb associated with the termination of his biological life. That's the circus on the summit of Mount Moriah, where his body, his physical life, ceased to exist. With rich people, he was elevated to the summit, his mountain, Bama, to the highest top of his ridgeline, which would be the highest point of the mount, in this case, Moriah. I've been there. an extraordinary place. The Most High had engaged him. Nothing wrong or violent, and nothing deceitful, nothing dishonest, lo mirmah, or deceptive, nothing deliberately misleading was spoken by him. 53:9. Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, as I was telling you, what had happened is when I broke down all these words in 53:9 as well as the others, the ones there was when I first started, and there's the first three words are Nathan or Nathan and F, which is with, and Rashah, which is wicked or criminal or guilty. And most of those are pretty easy to translate. And if you go to all 26 English translations that I, which are the largest chunk of them, it'll say something to the, his grave was assigned with wicked men or something like that. And it was just those three words, even though I did all the words, those three words kind of blew me away because no matter what you do, you can say to give, to put, to set in place, but it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on as far as meanings that you have in English. And the problem I had was I said, well, how many of these are pertinent? And just about all of them. And all of a sudden you get about 25 to 30 words that in English that could easily have been translated for Nathan. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is the most extraordinary language in the world. I mean, how the heck do you do that? Have so much depth. And then if you really break it down, you can connect almost every meaning of these to the very story that we're reading about. And if you look to the letters, you'll find the same thing. So before I throw that out at you for y'all's comments, I did one little thing I thought was would be fair. Is that I first looked at the English words and that are used to translate in English Bibles, and then to make sure that the word meanings hadn't changed over time to the degree that the culprit may have become modern speech as well instead of more Anglo-Saxon older English, or as opposed to not just for translations, but some things in the, I did find in the secondary meaning of these words in English that they chose to use do build a pretty nice little case, but they're so small that it's academic, you know, it's not really that big a deal. You wouldn't draw any conclusion from that. And then I started to analyze, and correct me if I'm wrong here. Yah obviously created Hebrew. We know that historically. We know that archaeologically. Everything we find goes back to the pictographs in Hebrew.
I want to add one thing to that.
Okay.
As a language, Hebrew is unique in that it mirrors light. That in Hebrew, time simply exists. All time. Hebrew is the only language I know where the author of the language, the creator of the language, and the language itself are the same. When Yahweh says that, you know, I became the Word, it's literally true. I mean, there is no other language where every statement exists throughout time. And it is a language where every verb is ascribed a stem, and every stem constructs and conveys an aspect of a relationship between the subject and object, between the person being spoken of and the one who is being spoken to. So here you have a language that is completely devoted to relationships, which is all Yahweh cares about, that is infinite in time, which describes Yahweh's nature, and that also has moods, and every mood is either first, second, or third person volition, free will. And that the only other aspect of the language are its conjugations, and in the conjugations it's either ongoing or completed.
Perfect, imperfect. Yeah.
And so it tells you, is this something that one and done is hits it done, Or is this something that has ongoing implications, something that maybe is speaking about habitual behavior that gives you so many opportunities to be expressive that the very nature of the language, even before you get, can't stop before you because I think the pictographs and the fact that the first actual alphabet in human history, the fact that alphabet is actually based on LF and AF.
Yeah.
But I think just the nature of the language itself is as close to being consistent with who Yahweh is as is the definition of light, the understanding of light when applied to Yahweh's nature. So I think Hebrew and light have an equal relationship to how we can best understand who Yahweh is.
Well, I got to the point where I'm starting to conclude that this language was created for only one reason, is to tell this story. Now, it functions as a, that we can make conversation with it, and we can go down to the grocery store and buy stuff, but that ain't the primary. This is a language to tell this love story, this relationship that he wants to build. And because it's just
so much
evident, which I'm going to try to point out to you in a minute and see what you think, but I want you to consider, I've been able to talk to quite a few people a couple of people in particular on this matter this week. Terry and Jackie were talking, and I was hanging out with them, and I mentioned, or she mentioned to me, and it reminded me that I had said earlier that ancient Hebrew is a language that only had about 10,000 words. Now it's grown about 12,000 or 15,000 or more because of modern words that have to be incorporated, computers and things like that. But it's primarily, it was designed for about 10,000 words. And it was a concrete language in the sense that it was meanings were could be easily related to your senses, feel, touch, something, as opposed to English or Greek or Latin, where you are talking more philosophical, where you have philosophy-based understanding of words. So if you added that up and then you realize that it has such a few words, it's so complete, and then you add the fact that it mirrors light that you just stated and all time exists and the verbs are not stuck in time, and the grammar being what it is, this is the most unconfusing language in the world. This guy communicates. This guy named Yahweh can communicate unbelievably, and he doesn't need very many words to do it. I mean, we go over the same words over and over and over again. And then I compare that to English. Now, English has, at last count I read a number of years ago, was 450,000 words, which is over, and they were overwhelmingly large numbers of Greco-Latin words. And as opposed to, and it's all philosophical based because they have adopted everything Greek and Roman. And if it isn't the greatest tool, to me, it's the English is the greatest tool for babbling that exists on the planet. I mean, it is a vehicle that has carried Christianity throughout the known world. And
it's a hodgepodge of about 8 or 10 different languages. That's why it makes English is so confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It adapts everything, like Christianity does. It adapts everything. You know, it's I'm sorry, you were going to say?
No, I just, you know, if you look at the terms that are important to Yahweh, he will have shadings on those terms that really help us identify who he's talking about. You just look at something like man. You know, Ish, Isha, Enoch, Adam. There's about 8 Hebrew words for man. Mortal man, political man, man of flesh, individuals, man that descended from the first man, Adam. These exist for a specific reason that he's trying to help convey that we're not all the same.
Yeah.
And so there are lots of
when there is a different word used, it's for a reason.
Right. Sometimes you'll have three different words for man in the same sentence. And so it's important to
give you,
take your time to see
words,
the differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. In these three words, I'm going to show you something that kind of freaked me out that I just did today. And I'm going, oh, I didn't get that the first time around, but I didn't approach old Mr. Weber, the dictionary. So what I did to try to build my case a little bit and see if it's can hold water is in the ton, or Nathan, as we like to say, the English translators translated Nathan as appointed, in most cases, made, like to make, or destined to, or suitable, or fitted.
Make is not the. There are so many primary words in Hebrew for make. Render Nathan as make. That's kind of a forced fit because
he's going to be made. Mm-hmm.
That's a stretch.
Yeah, it's quite a bit. And even appointed, you'll find some interesting little secondary and tertiary meanings that are thrown in where you can get to be determined by the authority and agreement, where you might have a connection to some degree to this story. But for the most part, it was just a pretty shallow translation. The third word, I think, was lie or laid. It calls to lie or to prostrate, to place, to put in, set in place, which is fine. And assigned.
But Hebrew again has a primary word for to put in place.
Yeah.
And so you would not have used Nathan to convey that when there is a verb that specifically and only conveys that.
Right. If you look at every one of these,
there's a Hebrew verb that is to make. So if God wanted to say to make, you would use the verb that says to make.
He used it a lot in Barbara Sheep.
Yeah.
Right. So since there are Hebrew words for to make and to put in place, if God wanted to say make or put in place, he has a perfectly suited word for those things. Right?
Well, this became what I was trying to find out. Well, why did Yahweh use Natan? Nathan. Because a few of the other Bibles used assigned a lot, mark out, and gave to convey to another, to grant, to pay, as a gift, to restore. And that's pretty good. So I said, okay, let's take a look at that. And then I moved over to everything I could find from lexicons, Hebrew lexicons. And now let me read off a little bit of a list, but let me read off some and I'll share with you, and y'all can jump in on how this. I remember we're talking about Yosha's, what's happening to Yosha is the backdrop of this, and the word he chooses is the gift. And you could simply say to give, to put, or to set in place, or you could say, you could also say, add, apply, appoint, ascribe, assign. Interesting, one of the translations says you can, one of the lexicons says to avenge, to heal. That's pretty close to the mark. To fasten and to frame. Well, he was fastened on the upright pole. He was, the framework was the Passover door, the Pesach door. To pay, recompense, perform. He obviously had to willingly perform this. It was requite. You often think of unrequited love. Requited love would be a response. To show forth, well, that's a witness. It was there showing the witness to the world that he was willing to pay such a price for his children to have his family. To trade, well, we paid a ransom. To do so willingly, volitional. Lexicons also say give personally. This was Yahweh giving personally. He didn't choose somebody else. It was his creation that did it, his set apart spirit on this child. To deliver by hand, I thought that was really interesting because it's the right hand we've been talking about. To bestow upon, to pay wages. A marriage vow, that's a metaphor used often, to give the sense of giving a woman to a man or as a wife. To give a sign or a wonder, that's fine. To give in exchange, Another ransom, another definition would be ransom, to assign and to designate. It was propitiatory, to give an offering, a set or an appointed time, which would be appointed, if you think appointing, if you think in terms of appointed time. Now we're back to a mikra. I mean, yeah, how do you get that many words in your definition that are so specific to the action that we're describing? I mean, I thought, wow, what language has a word like that? Somebody designed this long before we ever read it.
Right. Well,
then I went over and looked at the letter. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say that, it's not only the breadth of meaning of Nathan. Nathan is as central to what a father wishes to do for a son or daughter as any word that could possibly be conceived. With children, it's all about giving. And the more you give, the more you receive. I don't think there's anything other than children and a family setting where giving is more germane, more not only central to what we do, but central to what we receive.
Yeah. What I did next was go to the letters. And Natan is a nun with a tall and a nun. So you have two nuns in the center. You put a signpost along the way. This could be these two nuns. Y'all throw in your two cents. It could be male and female. It could be Yisrael and Yehuda. It can be Yisrael and Koi that accept the terms and conditions of what we find if we follow the signpost along the way. And the meaning in the ancient Hebrew would have been to place in proper position, to bestow by formal action, to present a gift, and also witness. And I thought, now look, everywhere I turn, Yah's selected words that he invented for this purpose, if I'm to believe my concept, he is overwhelming us with what. How could you teach it better? What else could he have said? You know, in all encapsulated one word about this story. And then I went, wow, that's pretty cool. Now the next word was quite interesting. F, of course, is with. And with is easy. You could say yes with something in English. You could say it's against something, like lean against, denoting proximity, alone, beside, near, within, in the presence of, near, before something. And that's fine. And you could pass on that and just say use the word with. And you can't do what I'm doing, Greg, because if you try to put all this together, nobody could read a sentence. This is more like commentary, to me, it's more like commentary or just studies to understand a little bit more of each one of those words, because it'd be overwhelming to do this, in a sentence, but you could certainly put it in as a side, or we can talk about it like we do on the show.
It's perfect for the show. It's, you're right, it's not perfect for the books, because if...
you never get the book done.
I think I push amplification about as far as I can, without losing people in the detail. And I may have actually crossed that line. I may have too much information. But it's appropriate for this, because the whole purpose of this show isn't to replace what's written. Because what's written is actually more valuable because it gives you the opportunity to check up things, to read it again, to think about it yourself, to consider all of the implications and validate them. This program is designed to go beyond it, to look at the same statements that we have provided in writing and to take the next step, to go deeper, to go beyond, to push the boundaries, to collectively...
Let me give you an idea of why... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, so you're doing exactly what the program has always been designed to accomplish.
Okay, good. You know, one thing that I thought of one time, just sitting around, you've often said, that the problem with the little adage when you take a classroom and you say something to one and they say it to the next and you play telephone and you go all the way down and it comes out totally different at the end. Isn't it amazing that Yah must have already known that because he gave everything in writing?
Mm-hmm.
So unless you twist the writing or scratch it out and put Adonai instead of Yahweh, you should be able. If I gave you a piece of paper that the first guy said, read it and then pass it on, it's going to come out the same way at the end. So,
correct.
Obviously,
right.
Writing is far superior to conversation, but the conversation is that we're having, of course, is just it's like carrying stuff.
Vastly superior. Vastly superior. It endures, and it can be passed along through the ages without changing. So, yeah, it is. When I hear people talk about oral tradition, I just cringe.
Yeah.
There's no way to learn anything. You just mentioned this word F. You know that 99% of the time that F appears in Hebrew, it's ignored. It's not translated.
I have heard that. I have read that it's often not used, yeah.
Yeah. And it means in accordance with, adjacent to, in relationship with, near, in proximity to, in accord with. It's an association term. It's a variation of Asher. You know, Asher is a relational term. But the difference with Asher is that Asher has, as a word written the same way, has about 10 profound connotations, where F is simply this associated term that doesn't go out of its way to establish the proper path or the narrow way or the correct approach or the means to the benefits inherent in the relationship, all of which Asher convey. F is just a very simple term that says this is with, this is in accord with, this is consistent with, this is near. But I find that most of the time you get a more complete and accurate meaning if you translate it, like I did here, in conjunction with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Kuber was the rock-hewn tomb. And then and those tombs were the place where there was the termination of biological life, the sepulcher. So, in association with the sepulcher. I think F is F, and you know it was presented here twice, and with the second time, Asher. So, yeah. You know, my favorite word of the words that are here is Bama, because Bama is the summit, and it was written in possessive as his, but Bama at the top of the ridgeline, the highest point of Mount.
I play for the mountain.
That's exactly where it occurred. It means that if you read what this says in Hebrew, you wouldn't have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
No.
Or you wouldn't have a church. You wouldn't have holy. And you wouldn't use sepulchre either, probably.
It's also called a Kodesh place, which no one would ever use as a translation either. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and we, you know, in a previous program, we talked about the Shema, which says that he said nothing that was destructive or that was wrong, that could have been misunderstood. And that's really important because it eliminates the possibility that Yosha would have said something that was in conflict with the Torah.
No.
Nothing deceitful, Mirma. No dishonesty, no deception, nothing deliberately misleading. No false impressions. So if Yahweh's word is true, he could not have said anything that was contrary to it.
No. Exactly.
Yeah.
And anytime you read through Matthew's or something and you see something you know is absolutely could not come out of his mouth, then you know that the translators have been busy.
That's correct.
Yeah, so you can dismiss that. It ain't there. Let me show you another aspect of width. So once again, I'm digging at the letters a little bit this time, and of course, F is written with an aleph and a tall. Now, I have seen it written with a aleph, a nun, and a tall, but the oldest one I can find is with aleph and a tall. And what you have there, of course, is you have a the Almighty, represented by the ram, pointing towards, from right to left, pointing towards the tall of the signpost along the way. So you have a lamb or a ram. Is the destination of a person could be the meaning of that. It can be the agreement by which an agreement by two, where the mark of the covenant rather is a reminder to both of the parties. So it's a mark between these two people. So everything you can probably dig up that I've been able to find in any case. If you want to just read those, it almost tells you the story, or it reinforces the story that you're trying to tell in 53:9. What I did also on this, just to make sure I'm being real fair, with F, I put with on a search and trying to find how else it could be used. And what I found that there are, if you put with in Hebrew, there are 20 different words that are translated by the English translators with. And most of them are, we're going to find one a little bit later in Barashi's 26:3 where they used M, which is a preposition, which is translated as with, used about 22 times. But the one that was used here was F, and it's, once again, it's against, as in proximity, along the side of, the side in the presence of, locality of, and one's knowledge of, memory of the right hand, handed from a power to a individual. The letters also mean while traveling towards the mark, as you, as the you has arrived at the me, which I thought, well, that was pretty clever. That's the way they put it. A standard of a flag, which the family mark hangs as a sign. That is the family mark, our family mark. An agreement or a covenant by two, where the sign of the mark of the agreement is made with the remainder of the two parties. So all three of those, I repeated one, all three of those gave a little more clarity to that. And if you look up all 20 of them, you'll find that most of those are quite specific in how you would use it. So when Yah uses these other 19 words for with, he usually has it, and you'll find it is very, very specific to what's being done. For instance, another word is used as with, translated as with, is Ethel, which is with me is God, or God with us. There's a few like Shimon. We all, you know, Shimon Kepesh, that's from Shema, from Shama, to listen. One who listens. We use the son of, he's also the son of Jacob. And interesting enough, it's also declared, also says when you look it up, it says with a foreign wife, which I found very good because he's an Israelite and he's married to a foreign wife, so the goyim obviously is part of the family, can be part of the family as well. So there's all kind of little neat stuff on that, and I have to labor it. But the third word is Rishah. So I look at Rishah. That one is translated when you multiple times, and is done as wicked, is done as criminal, and English translators will also use it as, they will translate it as felon when you see Rishah. Wicked is really interesting. I looked up wicked in the English dictionary, and its first definition is wizard. Second is witch. Its views are corrupted, views, depraved, bad, wrong, and mischievous. Mischievous is a really dirty word in Old English. It means twisting and being quite a rascal. When you look up criminal, when it's translated as criminal, it's the state of being, guilty of a crime, culpable, wicked, atrocity, abandonment, violates public, divine, or human laws. Another word that they will use to translate that, which is can be confusing if you're trying to figure out and read an English Bible. Felon. Felon is interesting. It means a traitor, means guilty of heinous crimes, hate, hatred, a malefactor, which is an evildoer, a evil but more to the point of being evil in speaking and in slander. Debilitating purpose to commit a crime, a deliberate person, purpose rather to commit a crime. So I looked to see what the Old English words were saying when they used it, and then I would then I went back to over here, and when you get to Rashaw, it's pretty good. It's wicked, criminal, evil men, guilty of crime, unrighteous, guilty of hostility to God or His people and His children, thus enemies of Yah. Rashaw is to act wickedly, condemned, departed. And the letters, of course, are a roach, and the teeth and the eye, which gives us the observant man using words for nourishing words to change their perspective, all going in the proper correction, going from right to left. Leaving the which is defined as, the older meanings are defined as leaving the required path may result in becoming lost and wicked, dysfunctional, and also depart from Yah's teaching and guidance, to depart from the correct path or the way. Remember, they were called followers of the way, either out of ignorance. Oh, by the way, you know, the Crestucians, the followers of the way, the Latin word, you know, that's in Marcus Aurelius's Roman histories. I have that on the shelf. I looked that up, and yeah, there it is. So they were called the followers of the way.
Followers of the way is such a perfect term, because mm-hmm. once you come to know the covenant, once you come to know the Mikre, once you come to know Yahweh's message, the only path to God is the way that He's articulated. Everything He has to say points to the way from the world of man to His perfect place. It's all about the way. So being called followers of the way, it's extraordinarily important.
Yeah.
They had it right. They didn't call themselves Messianic. They didn't call themselves Messianic. They didn't call themselves Yahusha Greeks.
No.
They most certainly didn't call themselves Christianios. They called themselves followers of the way. They were following Yahusha in the way of the covenant, the way of the Mishpat, the way of the Mikra. That's really don't ever underestimate just how important that bit of research is to affirm that in fact they were called followers of the way. The first people who were those who witnessed Yosha's fulfillment of his way, Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shavuah, were called followers of the way. That's really, really, really profound. And so you looked it up, and you found that indeed called followers of the way.
Yes. It's in the soft back cover of Marcus Aurelius' Histories of Roman Histories, and you keep digging around, and you'll find it. And, you know, it's anyway, the whole point of this exercise, and I know it's a little labored and stuff, but I kept going through this thing and saying, what language is this? I mean, what words are these that it's like they were all designed to tell Yashiya this story right here?
Yes.
It's almost freaky. I mean, you just go, wow. And I tried to say, I don't know Chinese, I don't know Russian, and I took a little bit of German, but other than that, I couldn't tell you squat about all the different languages, but I don't think you're going to find, number one, you're not going to find anything with letters that actually mean something, and you're not going to find words that are so pointed towards Yahweh, what Yahweh is talking about, and so consistent. You just can't. I mean, I realize some of them have a negative shading, and some of them have like Rashaw, but that's a negative word. It's evil, and people who don't follow the way, and so forth. But who made up this language? This is not a man-made language. This is just so wonderful to read and study and look at. So now the only trouble with translating, and let me say this to just a few people who were kind enough to email me and talk with me about translating, is everything about this is hard until it gets easy. It's difficult to start with, but believe me, it gets quite easy after a while. Even, and I tell everybody, just start with a few words and just go to about 6 or 7 lexicons and just read them, and you go, wow. And you'll find out that you ain't being led down the wrong path. You know, this is exactly what he said.
So, yes, this is exactly what he said. Now, I will tell you that there are places, Kirk, mm-hmm. where translating starts off as hard and becomes easy the more you do it. And the more you know who Yahweh is and what he is asking of us and offering in return, it becomes easier over time. There are places, like I'm in the midst of Yeshaya 16, as I'm moving around now and trying to deal with kind of my new life as it is. I'm all settled down and finish these chapters in Volume 2 of Observations for a Time Before Too Long. But there are words where he'll use ancient places to project characteristics that apply to later day. And mm-hmm. sometimes looking at those words, that can take a little effort.
Oh, this is just to look up, just to write them down takes a long time, and then you look at them and you read them and you go, okay, oh, that could mean, I can connect that dot. You know, it takes a while, but...
So there are times where it's not all that, not all that easy. So it's sometimes, if you know, somebody else is doing this, and I just want you to know that it's not always easy, right?
No.
Sometimes it's still hard. And by hard, we don't mean hard in the sense of, boy, that was a hard job, or that was a hard hike. We actually mean it just that it takes considerable effort and thought. It's still rewarding, but it just doesn't, you know, if you're doing this on your own and you find that it just doesn't come to you quickly, well, stick with it. It is an acquired talent. It is an art form, and you get better at it with practice. And don't be frustrated that it takes you a while. It took us a long time, and sometimes we come to passages that still takes us a long time.
Well, I've never viewed it where I had to rewrite what you're doing or what, because between you and JB, you know, that's pretty covered. I started out just trying to verify what y'all said, so I was really clear in my mind what you're saying, that I could find it there, because if I ever talk to somebody about it and they don't walk away, you could build your case on solid ground, you know. So that was the first thing, and of course, having been led down the wrong path as a Christian, I wanted to make sure that I don't do that again, and not that by misunderstanding something. But it does take a little while, but you know, I found a motto, if you like, or a statement somebody made. I can't tell you who it is, or I would, but it says the difficulties are meant to rouse, not to discourage. So they rouse you from your sleep. They open up your eyes to things, and it's these difficulties, meaning and how hard it is to begin something that you don't know. But the more you do it, it does build on, and you build on, and you build on. But I don't feel like I have to rewrite what y'all have written. All I have to do is look at it and see, is there a shading of it? Is there more to it that I can glean just for no other purpose, just for myself? And the more I do it, and the more I do it, the more you get the, you know what a gestalt is when you throw all this stuff at you. And that's where you learned how to speak, by the way. You didn't conjugate verbs when you were a little kid. You teach them a little word here and a little word there and this, that, and the other, a little phrase here and a little phrase there, and all of a sudden your brain just kind of puts it all together to start learning. Is that way? This is the way I kind of approach this. I would do this, and then I would do that, and it may not have any rhyme or reason at the first part, and then later I got where I could go from sentence to sentence or try to keep up with what you were writing. And after a while, you just, all the dots start connecting. You say, oh, you know, I've done that before. That's where it meant, oh, yeah. That's the way you learn.
Yeah.
That's where you learn everything else.
Yeah.
So,
And the best way to learn is to do, to be actively engaged. It's mm-hmm. the thing that I tell people all the time, that if you want to learn, you've got to engage so that you've got all of your tactile senses working. You're using your eyes, you're using your ears. So sometimes I find myself all the time, even when I'm alone, reading these words out loud.
Mm-hmm.
I'll even read sentences out loud, because by hearing them, by voicing them, I'm reinforcing the message. And I retain the message because I transition from long-term to short-term memory. And then if I ponder a little bit and then I type some, now I'm doing more and more things that help to make it more vivid, more actionable, and you're transitioning from the short to long-term memory. And then you can apply them and try to use them and extrapolate from them. All of these things develop a base of knowledge. And then you take the next step once you have a considerable base of knowledge and you can see the connections between things. When you relate them together in the proper way, then you get the greatest blessing of all, which is understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process, and it's a growth process that we were given as a tremendous gift.
Anyway,
thank
you for that. That was about my research for the week. So
yeah, outstanding. And so this is what Yahweh said next. And so it was the will and purpose, the Shepha, it was the choice, the inclination, the desire, to bend down even the pleasure of Yahweh. So this tells us a lot. You know, people constantly ask, I want to know God's will for my life. Well, God's telling you His will. This was my Shepha. This is my will. This is my purpose. This is my choice. This is what pleases me, says Yahweh. For him to suffer the effect of being crushed. Why would it please God for the diminished manifestation of his nature and his very soul to be crushed?
So he didn't have to crush us.
Right, so that his children would be spared pain. So his children would be enriched. So his children would be empowered. So his children would be perfected. So his children would be right. He was doing what every loving parent does on behalf of their sons and daughters. Yes, it brings us pleasure to do these things on behalf of our children. It brings Yahweh. We should not feel bad for Yahweh that he endured these things. It's what he wanted to do. We can thank him for it.
Mm-hmm.
But we ought not feel, the things we ought to feel sad for Yahweh is the fact that he's done it and people besmirch him for it. They corrupt it. They twist it. They disregard it. They demean it. That we ought to feel sorry for. The fact that Yahshayah told us that when he appeared in Shamayim and he looked at Yahweh and saw, and no one is there.
Did you think about that just a minute? You know, two things about being Christ. One, of course, is Matzah and Sheol.
Right.
And the second thing that just struck me is, you know, the Ka is a doorway, a delete, a cough, a hand, or
right,
a welcoming hand to Aleph, which is around
right,
the Almighty. I mean, what an interesting, this is a negative thing, being crushed, yet the word used is something that is telling you a story of go through the doorway, it's opening the doorway to greet you, to be with y'all. That's, who makes up that?
Yeah, who
makes
it? Just looking at my email, one of my really special close friends, a man that had played such a role in lifting up and conveying the neck, this sign that Yahweh showed to the world and which has been so valuable to helping us initially communicate this message. Jerry from McLaughlin is just wrote me and says, you know, as covenant members, should we just tell people that we are followers of the way?
Good.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. You know, because one of the problems saying that we're covenant is that people don't understand covenant. They think that covenant is a religious term when covenant means the family-oriented relationship. That's what Bereth means, it's a family-oriented relationship. But people don't understand that. If you say we're followers of the way, what way? Well, the followers of the way that, articulated for us to be free of the corruption and revolt of human religion and politics and to walk to him and live with him in his perfect realm. in his home, his family. I think he's right. I think that would be a good term.
It's a good opening, isn't it?
Oh, we're followers of the way. This goes on to say, he interceded by infecting him with the plague.
Chala. There you go. Chala.
Yeah. He facilitated his infirmity. He sickened him with the disease. So with the hippo stem, the subject, Yahwa, causes the object, the Osha, to participate in this process as if they were one and the same. Although for a definite period of time, in the perfect conjugation, from chul to twist and anguish via circular reasoning, and chala to profane, to pollute, to defile, to dishonor, and to displease through prayer.
Yeah, I love that.
I tell people all the time, because I'm meeting so many new people these days, I tell people, like, God does not want us to worship Him, which would be, it should be so obvious that a superior being creating an inferior being for the purpose of worshiping Him would not be worth knowing. That would be one screwed up dude. And, you know, the idea we can lift up God as opposed to Him lifting us up is obviously, as they say, back-asswards.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing that, you know, because even non-religious people pray when things get bad, or in particular over their children, they want to have that little extra bit of insurance.
Yeah.
He was an agnostic prayer. He only had one prayer. If you exist, reveal yourself to me. And I tell people, God has never asked us to pray to Him. Never once. That isn't a thing you shouldn't have a conversation with Him. I do. All the time. He never once asked us to pray to Him. Never once. And if people say, well, how can that be? I said, well, how would you like to compare your intellect to God's? If two people are talking, nobody hears anything. Now, if one of the two of you are going to talk and one of the two of you are going to listen, can you tell me who should be talking and who should be listening based upon your relative understanding and intelligence and what you have to say that might be worthwhile?
Yeah.
It's so intuitive to me that He wouldn't ask us to pray to Him. But He asks us all the time to listen to Him. Come on, people, figure it out. So He interceded by inflicting Him with the plague through the concession and condition of appointing His soul to suffer the punishment and serve as compensation. Well, again, you know, we always talk about Psalm 22 because it's the most relevant, but also Psalm is more 88. But Yeshaya 53 is future history. You don't need no stinking New Testament to know what happened. No. This explains what happened, and it explains in terms that are vastly more insightful and accurate. It was His soul that fulfilled the mission, and if it was His soul, He didn't die. If it's His soul, something happened marvelous on Matzah that we ought to understand. That's where His soul went into Sheol on Matzah, covered with the plague. Why? Because we are infected with that plague. And He's the antidote. So He was punished for our compensation. That's essential to understand because it enables God to render us right when we have been wrong. Because He Himself paid the price, so He's not being capricious. The penalty, the price, has been paid. The sentence has been lived out. We have been ransomed from our captors. Then He will actually and continually look upon His offspring, Zerah, this is speaking of Yosha, because He will prolong His days. He will lengthen His time. The will and affairs, the Shekinah
again,
Yahweh, through His hand, will
look upon His offspring, Zerah.
And we've been so clear about
He will prolong His days.
There's no letter more important to Yahweh.
Because He will prolong His days.
Reaching down and out.
We began this by talking
about the Zeruah, the sacrificial lamb of God, which also is the hand of God.
We may have lost him, JB. You want to read
the word? that we are considering these words are the outstretched open hand of God.
So did you guys hear me?
To grasp hold of us.
I'm not hearing Craig or Kirk.
Well, I'll raise your commentary until we get him back live again.
This is
once
the
outstretched
hand of God.
Once again, he said, since Yahweh is belaboring the point because Yahusha's
doing this so that his sons and daughters
can prosper. Or even later in the tomb, the suffering associated with diminishing and pressure was endured on Masa when Yahusha's soul was dispatched to the singularity of Sheol, which is in effect a black hole. The Chala, the plague, to which Yahweh is referring, is the deadly pandemic of religion. He was infected with it because he represented the yeast he had to remove from us on unyeasted bread, Masa, for us to appear perfect. His willingness to accept our asham, our punishment in as compensation, is what makes Yahweh's plan, his misbah, the one we were talking about earlier, a just means to resolve disputes. He thereby reconciles our relationship by offering to remove our guilt, restoring us from the damage we had done to ourselves by being wrong.
Yeah, you cut out on me there, Kirk, but all of that, I'm sure everybody else got to hear and is it's found insight in Yahweh's nature, what he was willing to do for our success so that we could succeed, so we could thrive, so we could advance to the next level, all shalach, right? That's what his hand was there for. So out of the difficult and miserable toil of his soul, he will actually continuously see the light abundantly overflowing and providing complete satisfaction. His soul went in to heal and purged his light as energy. That's how he could go. That's why he told the women, don't touch me right now. That energy would have killed them. That's why they didn't recognize him while he was the gardener. That's why the next thing we do, we see him 60 stadia out of town on the road to Emmaus. They didn't recognize him either. And then instantaneously after conversation and eating with the gentleman, he literally travels through the wall into the upper room. He's teleported. This is the ability of light to be anywhere at any time. This is that transition between energy and matter that Einstein so eloquently equated as E equals MC squared. That is what's occurring here. And the light enveloped his soul. What is the light of Yahweh in this world? The set apart spirit. The set apart spirit and Yahusha's soul, Yahweh's soul, were connected once again, abundantly overflowing, providing complete satisfaction, overwhelmingly and abundant. So, the Shaba means just an overwhelming abundance, satiated the light and his soul. Isn't that a beautiful presentation of what occurred at the end of Matzah as we transition into Bikurim? That's what's going to happen to us, by the way. We are going to have our souls immersed in an abundant and overflowing, overwhelming, exceedingly great, completely satisfying amount of Yahweh's light. So it's not only saying, this is what happened to Yahusha's soul on Bikurim, it's forecasting what the followers of the way are going to experience happening to our souls as a result of Bikurim. And then he says, this is so important. Dayat is empirical knowledge, knowledge that leads to understanding, appreciating the facts, considering the evidence of Dayat. By way of knowing and understanding him, through skillfully ascertaining the connections pertaining to the information regarding him, through perception and discernment, Dayat, of course, is from Yada, to learn and to know, to recognize and acknowledge, to be acquainted with and familiar with, to be discerning and discriminating, to understand by way of instruction. My servant, my Ebed, well, that doesn't make him, you know, a Christian. Well, he was a son of God. Well, how do you mean that? He was a servant. He was an implement of Yahweh. He was a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. He was something that Yahweh used to accomplish this task. My servant will make righteous and upright, declaring absolutely acquitted and vindicated. Is there a better word than tzedak in the whole Hebrew language? And here, it is tzedak, tzedak. This is the epitome of being right, of being upright, of being declared acquitted and vindicated. This is the purpose of the mishpat, the purpose of Pesach and Matzah. It is primarily the derivative of Matzah. So we are become right and vindicated, even though we have been guilty, because he bore that all the wrong associated with us. I hope I'm not hearing you at all, Kirk, in the background. Are we still connected? I hope we, I certainly hope that we are, and that we're still broadcasting this evening, because it is challenging. I'm here in a, in fact, I hear now that nothing has been said as far as I know. I can't hear Craig or Kirk anymore. And I'm betting they can't hear each other. So I think we have been disconnected. Well, I'm hoping that you can hear me now. I'm looking at the chat room, and I noticed that when I could no longer hear Kirk, that it was also the concern that no one could hear me. I do not know if you can hear me at this time. If somebody is in the chat room and can acknowledge that we're continuing to broadcast, that would be wonderful. But otherwise, I'm going to assume that the internet connection here has just failed us, and then we'll have to pick up on another time. It said that JD says, I guess, that he can hear us now. So that's at least encouraging. Perhaps there's a way to bring both back in. I'm going to attempt to do that. Let's hope that something works. But anyway, I will continue where we were, in hopes that we are continuing to record and broadcast. But tzedak is as powerful as there is any term in Hebrew. Yahweh has clearly stated here that what was done on matzah, particularly as matzah was in Bikurim, recognizing that Pesach, matzah, and Bikurim are one event. Eternal life, perfection, and adoption into Yah's family, literally being enveloped in his life, so that we can be right, so that we can be vindicated. That all of those things are united, and it all occurred because of what Yahweh did through the sacrificial lamb, through his hand, by way of his soul, on these 3 days, all on our behalf. So, it is extraordinarily important that we understand specifically what is being conveyed. We move on, and I'll just cover one more statement, hoping that we are continuing to communicate. It says, honestly, therefore, him, this is right and correct, just and proper, and thus certain. As a result of him, I will apportion and disperse everyone's share. Shalom. Share. Share what? Well, the inheritance. Well, what inheritance? The inheritance of being part of the covenant. Well, how is that? What inheritance? That was the question that Abraham asked, wasn't it? Yeah, well, how is it that I'm going to inherit all these marvelous things that you're talking about when I don't have an heir, I don't have a son? And then Yahweh explained, took him up to light, and he said, look at the spiritual realm and consider the light of the stars. And that's what you're inheriting. And now Yahweh is coming out of this statement where he says that Yosha's soul, Yahweh's soul, is being immersed in light in the fulfillment of Bikurim of firstborn children. He's explaining exactly what we inherit. And here he's saying again, this is what you're inheriting. You're inheriting the right to be transformed into light. But what does that mean? Well, that means you're immortal. What does that mean? It means you're perfect. What does that mean? It means you're enormously empowered. It means that you can now travel to and travel with the creator of the universe. That it means
you can actually enjoy that.
Right, that your nature and art and his nature are going to be the same. Well, thanks for not giving up on us, JB. I know that we're having connectivity issues.
I think Blog Talk Radio's entire switchboard crashed. I couldn't get it to come back up in any browser or anything, and then all of a sudden it worked again. So.
Oh, so that,
I think they had an issue.
Perfect. All right, so it's not just the connectivity. In fact, it sounds like part of the problem, and it's equally the problem, is the Blog Talk Radio is failing on us this evening.
Yeah.
The platform.
Yeah.
Okay. No, but, you know, I think that I'm just going to say something that might sound silly, but part of being in a relationship with Yahweh is we just don't fret the setbacks. Okay? We were here. We're ready to share his message to us. We're passionate about it. We're thrilled to be able to do it. And, of course, we received some curveballs that made it challenging. Doesn't cause me to be the least bit disappointed. You know, we're not, God's not asking us to find a perfect platform or to never fail. He's just saying, you know, you celebrate my word and don't be upset. Don't be troubled when curveballs come your way. And sometimes that's the best way to understand whether someone is genuine. We stick with it. We try again. We come back. And when you do that, you know, can you just right where you left off? Can you take the curves along the way and still find the straight path? And by the way, you're clearly right, JP, because when we began this show, the switchboard was, there wasn't any free lines left. You know, you can look at the switchboard, and you can scroll down and scroll down and scroll down, and every possible line on the premium plan was filled. And yet now I look at it, and I came back up, and there were three lines, and I think there's now seven.
Yeah. And it looks like things are starting to work again. I sent Kirk an email, told him to call back in, and I'd watch for his number.
Yeah, and I've got him reconnected. That doesn't mean that he can hear us or talk, because I don't think the switchboard is working. But a portion everyone share is, and then he says, and with many and in abundance. Well, what we're inheriting is all our Father has to offer. Now, our Father happens to be a pretty rich dude. You know, I was walking today with somebody, and they were anti-religious. So I said, you know, it just amazes me that people think they need to give God money. What's God going to do with money? Do you think God has a shortage of credit? You think he's out spending money in heaven? Do you think there's something on earth that he wants to buy? And yet, he's overflowing in abundance. The universe is his. He's giving it to us. Life is his. He's giving it to us. Time is his. He's giving it to us. Teaching and instruction are his. He's giving it to us. We're being adopted into his family. We are heirs to the creator of the universe. That's as good as a share becomes. I'd rather have a 1 billionth share of what Yahweh has to offer than I would be the richest man on earth.
Yeah. And all the gold is
worth it. Yeah, we are the... Well, there's no more gold in Fort Knox, so that's probably...
Yeah.
That's just a metaphor now. And with the empowered, the atzum, which talks about the reward that we're going to have, with the empowered, that is our abundance, with the enriched, a share and a portion, that which is valuable. Money is not valuable. It just isn't. Time is valuable. Being right is valuable. Understanding is valuable. Being with Yahweh is valuable. Being part of the covenant family is valuable. He's going to apportion that which is valuable based upon an orderly, sequential, and rational arrangement. Teshach is one of my favorite terms because my whole approach to life is God's just orderly. He's sequential. He's rational. And everything has been arranged in a way that is just straightforward, easy to understand, rational, reasonable. And I love his approach. There's a sequential approach. Pesach comes before Matzah, but it is never separated from Matzah. Lakutim is the result. Shavua speaks to empowerment and enrichment. Teruah is the natural consequence where we want to share that man is wrong and God is right, which ultimately leads to Yahweh's promised reconciliation with his people and his family on Yom Kippur, so that ultimately we can all Shabbat camp out with him. We can't camp out with him. We can't Sukkah in such time as we are Pesach and Matzah and Bukkudim and Shavuah. Right? We can't Sukkah in either of those things. There's a sequential order and an arrangement that has to follow. You can't trust Yahweh and reject human schemes until such time as you have walked away from the human schemes. You can't engage in a relationship unless you acknowledge the prerequisite is to walk away from politics and religion. That's why it comes first. It's a sequential order of things. Even circumcision as the sign of the covenant can't come before anything else. It has to follow it in terms of what we do with our son, because it's our acknowledgement. It's our signature.
Yahweh clearly states you can't participate and benefit from Pesach unless you're circumcised. That's step one right there.
Right.
And being circumcised does you no good if you haven't walked away from religion.
Correct. Because then you don't understand what you did. Doesn't have any value.
You know, even the terms and conditions have an order, and the order is kind of the necessary order.
Correct. Oh, yeah. The story is told from the order it has to be told. The story of creation. The story of Adam in the garden. The addition of Chawa to the garden. What happened when Hasatan lost in the garden. How that led to the story of Babel and corruption. And to the Nephilim and the horrid people that were promoting religion and militarism and politics. And that ultimately led to Yahweh having to react and the cleansing that took place with that blood and where it transpired and when it transpired. And ultimately, all of that led to Yahweh reaching out to Abram after he had walked out of Babel and leading him into the promised land. The story all follows the sequence. It's told in the right order. And it's important for us to recognize that and to read it and to understand it and to appreciate it in that order. Out of order,
it goes out to all the Christians who tell you, don't worry about all that Old Testament stuff. Just start with the New Testament. How are you ever going to understand that if you don't read what came before it?
Well, first of all, there is no New Testament. But beyond that, correct. If you don't start at the beginning, you'll never understand the end. That's why they don't understand what he did. They have no concept of who the person is or what he did because they don't start at the beginning. It's hopeless. Well, why don't we pick it up here again next week? We've had so many challenges with the connectivity. I do think that this would be a great place for us to say goodnight. And to pick up next week. Thanks for sticking with us, JB. Thanks for writing in the chat room so I knew where we were on all of this. And, Kirk, I loved your contribution to the show this evening, and I'm sorry that you were consistently cut off. It just happens sometimes.
Yep. BTR is imperfect.
We're here. We're all here. We learned something. We've got to celebrate our happy Shabbat.
Yep.
Good night.
You have a good weekend. Have a good Shabbat.
Good night.